Hi, I'm T2, and I support Gen X Grown Up through Patreon because they're super gentle to my wires and boards. I think you should, too. Go to patreon.com/GenXGrownUp.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X Grown Up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown-Up podcast listeners, to this, the Backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown-Up podcast. I am John. Joining me, as always, is George. Hey, man.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Would not be a show without Mo.
How's it going, everybody?
It's going great. 35 years ago, the spirits of a deceased couple were being harassed by the family that moved into their home. Against their better judgment, they ultimately summoned a malicious spirit for help, but got way more than they bargained for. In this Backtrack, we're looking back at the landmark Gen X supernatural comedy, Beetlejuice. I'm only going to say it once. Before we get into that, though, it is time for some fourth listener email. And this is someone wrote in about a recent Backtrack that we did. Brandon G hit us up, and the subject line of his email is Eddie Murphy's Delirious.
Ooh.
Right? Here's what Brandon has to say. Guys, I am so glad you did an episode about this classic stand-up comedy special. Woo, we're off the hook.
Yeah, right. Really.
I can't believe you did this. Right now, wasn't that? Brandon says, it is my all-time favorite. The first time I saw it was when my older brother's friend brought it over on VHS.
Oh, yeah.
My brother put the tape in and told his friend and I that the plan was to mask the obscenities from our mother in the next room. We would just start coughing every time Eddie cursed.
They got COVID back in 1980.
I know, really.
You're getting ahead of me. Needless to say, it was a stupid idea. We coughed so much that the living room sounded like the doctor's office during flu season, and my mom mm-hmm. heard all the cursing anyway.
That's what some kids would come up with as a plan.
Right. Yeah, I love how you guys connected the dots before I got there. Like, wait a minute, every time there's cursing, hold on.
Yeah.
Brandon says, she waited for a while and finally called out, boys, I hear that, shut it off. But that didn't stop us because later that night, after mom and dad went to bed, we popped the tape into the VCR in my bedroom and laughed our asses off. No coughing necessary.
There you go.
He says, my favorite parts are the ice cream man and the G.I. Joe in the bathtub. I laughed hysterically at both of those. Thanks again for such a great episode and continued well wishes to all three of you, Brandon.
Nice.
Cool.
Nice. Thank you, Brandon. Those are exactly the kind of stories we love reading in emails that you heard this Backtrack. You're like, oh my God, that's my thing, right? That's my favorite, whatever. You never know which one you're going to hit on, but we hit for Brandon, his favorite stand-up special. We're glad we did. And thank you for writing in to let us know. Fourth listener, if you would like your email featured here on the show, it is so easy. Just hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. We read every single one of them, and most of them, like Brandon's, will eventually make it to the show. All right. It is time to head back to 1988, 35 years ago, to the origin of Beetlejuice, right after this. Stick around.
What was it like to be there for historical sports moments and unforgettable performances? To be behind the scenes? On Pressbox Access, you'll hear from me, Todd Jones, and other sports writers about their experiences with the greatest athletes, coaches, and sports events of the past half century. We'll share some stories behind the stories, some big, some small, and some we've only told each other. Let us buy you a round on Pressbox Access.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
From the director of Pee-wee's Big Adventure. When two ghosts can't talk the living into leaving their house.
What's the good of being a ghost if you can't frighten people away?
They call the ghost
Beetlejuice
with the most.
Yeah. Can you be scary?
What do you think of this?
This is amazing.
Michael Keaton is a ghost called Beetlejuice.
I'm the ghost with the most, babe.
Rated PG. Sneak preview Saturday, March 26th.
If you were alive in 1988 and you enjoyed any pop culture, you were definitely aware of Beetlejuice. It's like a film that defies categories. It's supernatural. It's a little bit horror, maybe. It's definitely a comedy. It's definitely fantasy. It's everything. And I think to everybody is probably why it ended up being so popular. And we're going to get into all of that. But first, George, as he often does, did the bulk of our research for us for this backtrack. And this first bit that you brought us really kind of talks about the situation with Tim Burton and what was going on with him as a director leading up to the origin of Beetlejuice getting off the ground.
Yeah, so it'll probably surprise some people to find out that Beetlejuice is not a Tim Burton creation. Yes, he directed it, but unlike Edward Scissorhands or Pee-wee's Big Adventure or anything, it wasn't like his thing that he molded at the beginning. So he had just come off of being super financially successful from Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was 1985, right?
Oh, yeah.
That basically made him in Hollywood what they call a bankable director. Studios were okay with giving him projects because he had made money, right?
Yeah.
He started immediately to work on a script for Batman, which we know he made a little bit later on and very successful and started the whole superhero franchise things that we know. I mean, it was the first start, in my opinion, for a lot of that stuff.
The first great one.
Yeah. But Warner Brothers, they were willing to pay for its development, but they weren't quite ready to green light it yet. So he's like, all right, shit, I got to find something else to do. He kept getting scripts for different things. One of them, believe it or not, was this Richard Dreyfuss movie that I remember seeing on HBO called Hot to Trot. He got the script for that and said, nope, that's not for me. I'm passing on that movie. But then David Geffen, the head guy of Geffen Studios, came to him and said, hey, look, here's a script from this guy named Michael McDowell, who had just done a script for another thing called The Jar, which was an old Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode. Hmm. He's like, I think this has something. Take a look at it and see what you think. And it was called Beetlejuice.
Okay.
Well, obviously, Burton said, yep, that's exactly what I want to do with my life. Let's move into Beetlejuice. And I think it was the perfect casting of a director for a script that you could ever imagine.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, before I did any digging at all, I thought it was his thing because it aligns so well with the tone of his movies, doesn't it? Yeah. Like a little weird and creepy and out of left field. So what a great fit. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, even early days when they started doing test screenings, they said like they were all met with like just huge positive feedback, you know? Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's so many. I think that the end credit scene where Beetlejuice like pisses off the witch doctor, he filmed that like after getting all this positive feedback. So I guess he wanted to do some more work with him and just wanted to keep it going. So
yeah, that wasn't even part of the original script. It was just an extra epilogue to the movie. It was really fun. Now, you want to talk about successful. So Beetlejuice budget was $15 million, which was a sizable, but not crazy budget for that time period. The interesting part, though, was they only gave $1 million to the visual effects.
And there's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. But that's exactly why some of them come off campy B movie style, because Tim Burton recognized that they only gave him $1 million. And he purposefully wanted to do a lot of the stop motion kind of stuff with the sandworms and everything. Yep. He wanted to do them B movie style because he felt like it was funnier. So that was a conscious decision, even though it was kind of led there by the budget. Now, we want to talk about it being a success. It was a critical success, but also a commercial success. It grossed $74 million off of that budget, which is $194 million today on what would have been today a $39 million budget, $15 million back then. So
that's enormous,
ridiculous numbers.
Good return on investment,
especially for the type of film it was.
Right. And hard to pigeonhole. Like, what kind of movie is it? Just go see it.
Go see it. You'll love it. Right. It opened on that first weekend to $8 million that time, which is $20 million dollars today. Jeez. So imagine a $20 million opening weekend for a movie like Beetlejuice. It's no wonder that he didn't keep getting script after script after script after this. And this was really one of the reasons why Batman ended up getting greenlit later on.
Yeah. Keep having success.
This is not a flash in the pan. Pee-wee wasn't just, just a fluke, right? It's like, and now I've done Beetlejuice.
At that point, they could say, it wasn't Pee-wee Herman that made that movie. It was Tim Burton that made it successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And once Tim Burton got involved, this is another part that makes me probably always think of this as a Tim Burton originated thing, is because he started bringing in his people. He got Danny Elfman to do the soundtrack of this thing. How much more perfect? I mean, we've done a whole backtrack on Danny Elfman. He is an amazing composer.
Yeah.
Especially of the weird and quirky, right? He came back to do Batman. He did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, right? He's done Edward Scissorhands, so much stuff for him. And the score for this is that same kind of, and even The Simpsons that Elfman has done.
Yeah.
All of his big scores sound like a maniacal calliope clown car kind of thing. It's kind of bouncy and exciting and a little creepy and minor. Yeah. Right. It's that kind of thing. And you hear that throughout Beetlejuice, where you have that is like, you could out of a lineup go play me three scores. Oh, that's an Elfman. And it is on full display in Beetlejuice.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was a partnership that they kept going for quite a few movies too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They continued to. Yeah.
And, you know, every movie goes through like casting choices, right? Like, oh, we didn't get our A person, we got our B person. Sure. And that seemed, and that always works out better sometimes, right? Than what they expected.
Right.
But some of the things I'm reading about this, I'm wondering if this is true because this seems so bizarre. Like, his original choice for Beetlejuice was Sammy Davis Jr.?
Yeah, 100% true.
I mean, I was like,
he liked Sammy Davis Jr. a lot. He was a big fan of Sammy Davis Jr. and he always wanted to cast him. Remember, this is one of his early films, so he's trying to get to work with the people he admires. Whether or not he's right for the role. He's like, I want to work with Sammy Davis Jr.
I tried to imagine that. What would that look like? I mean,
he'd be dancing.
Sammy Davis Jr. can be kind of quirky. It'd be more dancing. Think about it, though.
Sammy Davis Jr. was coming off of a significant comedy run in films. He had done the Cannonball Run movies.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Right.
So,
he can be quirky.
He was a moderately bankable film comedy guy.
Yep.
Yeah,
I can see that, I guess.
And then the producers also considered like Dudley Moore and Sam Kennison, which also, I just don't see it. I have a hard time. I mean, Sam Kennison would just be insane, but
I could see Sam Kennison dancing to that whorehouse.
Oh man. I would love to visit a parallel universe where Sam Kennison is Beetlejuice. That is something. I don't want to replace Keaton, but I want to visit a world where he is Beetlejuice. Mm. That would be absolutely bananas. Okay. I would be in for that. Dudley Moore, he's too dry. He's kind of flat. I think of him as, he's.
Let him do the next author sequel and we'll keep Sam Kennison for the Beetlejuice in the alternate universe.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, to your point, though, one of the reasons why I say you got to keep Michael Keaton in the role in your Earth Prime universe, wherever you're at.
Yes.
You know, where we live. All of those great lines that he did, I'm the ghost with the most, babe, and all that kind of stuff. It was very much like what Bob Uecker did in Major League. 90% of those lines were ad-lib.
Holy shit.
Tim Burton just gave him the reins and said, fuck it. We're just going to keep rolling. Do what you want. And, like, you think about that scene where he's meeting the Maitlands for the first time. And they're like, what are your qualifications? Well, I attended Juilliard and I did it. That's all ad-lib. That's crazy.
I'm positive you're talking to a dead guy.
Well, he's such an iconic piece of this movie that it stunned me to read that in this film, which is about 85 minutes, I think, it's almost full hour and a half movie.
Yeah, yeah.
14.5 minutes of him on screen. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. But when you bring him out, it's like, look, we don't bring out the big guns for every scene, but when we need him, we bring him out and he absolutely steals the show. Yeah. He stole every scene. He stole every scene. He's the name of the movie, of course, but he's only in it when you absolutely have to be there. His shadow is cast over the film the entire time because you know he's out there and you know he's coming and you know they're going to summon him, but you don't spend a lot of time with him so that when you do, the impact is like, boom, a nuclear bomb just went off and here's Keaton doing his thing. And it was staggering.
Yeah.
I thought it was really funny that, look, it was called Beetlejuice. Even initially, it was called Beetlejuice. And initially, they were going to call it the constellation Beetlejuice. And of course, we were talking before, George learned that test audiences called it Beetlegeist.
Yeah.
Just like Alec Baldwin's character did in the movie when he mispronounced it.
Right.
And I'm like, that's confusing. So we'll call it Beetlejuice, spelled the way it is. They thought about calling it House Ghosts. Not bad, except
that's what the studio wanted.
The studio did, right?
Yeah.
Burton said, that's garbage. Let me give them a worse title so they'll fall back to Beetlejuice. He said, how about Scared Sheetless? And the studio went, first of all, it's funny, right? The no feet picture, that's all cool. Right. Then the studio was like, oh, that's not too bad. And Burton's like, oh, no, I was kidding. Let's fall back to Beetlejuice, which it ultimately was. But look, House Ghost sounds kind of lame. I would have watched Scared Sheetless. That's kind of funny. I would have seen that. But name it after Beetlejuice. I'm glad it stayed there in our Prime universe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Tim Burton also, he's kind of a master of subtleties. There's a lot of different things that he does in his films that you have to really have a quick eye. You have to maybe hit that pause button on your VCR to be able to see. John, for you, something that's in this movie that you get to see in one of your favorite movies later on, there's a place where there's like a little the circus kind of thing where the horses spin around and stuff.
Carousel.
Thank you. The very top of it is a skull. That skull is the same one that got used for the drawing designs of Jack Skellington from Nightmare Before Christmas later on.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
That's very cool.
But one of the cute little things that to me, that kind of warms my heart, you know how the Maitlands die? They're going back home after stopping by the store. They go through the bridge. There's a dog in front of them. They swerve to avoid the dog. They go through the sidewall of the tunnel bridge thing, and then they drown in the river. Well, the bumper sticker on the back of their car says, "I break for animals."
True to their word.
Maybe you shouldn't have broken for that damn dog. Yeah.
In hindsight.
And then that dog is standing on the lever that's keeping them from falling. What and the dog just kind of looks at him and goes, nah, screw you guys. The dog takes off. I was looking up how you talked about the financial success, and I wanted to check on the critical success. And I go to the aggregator of all things movies, Rotten Tomatoes. And had I looked at this a week ago before I rewatched the film, I might have felt it was kind of low. But in rewatching it, I think this is a really strong and representative number.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty close. 86% critics, 82% audiences.
Yeah, that's pretty
good. It is kind of a B movie kind of thing. The beauty of this is in the effects and the performances. I don't think it's the most polished script ever. I don't think it's the most polished dialogue ever, though there are some notable pieces of dialogue.
There's some good,
As a whole, though, 86 feels like a respectable number for this movie, and it sounds about right. And I think early on, even after it wasn't a huge hit when it first came out, it gained acclaim after people started to see it more, and it's likely because it's hard to describe. What kind of movie is it?
It did do $8 million opening weekend, so it wasn't not a hit either.
Right, it wasn't
pretty solid.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think between an 85 and a 90 is where I would have put the score. Somewhere like around 87 and a half or so. So 86 is right.
Not too far off. I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about like how it was people thought of the movie. I mean, it was up for a whole bunch of awards and it won a whole bunch too. But actually, I didn't realize this. It was Tim Burton's first Oscar was for this one, which was
for good
best
for him.
Makeup. It was for best makeup, you know, not director or anything like that. But it was the first movie he was associated with that actually won an Oscar, though. That, you know, and that, I mean, like you said, at that point, it's like, oh, we won an Oscar. I'm doing Batman. I mean, you know.
Right. For the Oscar winning director, well, sort of.
Yeah.
Tim Burton.
Right.
All right. I think we set the stage pretty well. We know the premise, what's going on. We get back from this break. We're going to talk about the amazing characters and the actors that brought them to life. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dino Tripodis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dino Tripodis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show, too. It helps more than you know.
Showtime.
Everyone loves Beetlejuice. Hilarious, a much bigger gut buster than Ghostbusters, declares the Village Voice. An uproarious ghost comedy. Nothing like it since Ghostbusters, says the Los Angeles Times.
This is amazing.
Thank you.
And USA Today calls Beetlejuice original, imaginative, and crowd-pleasing. Michael Keaton is...
I'm the ghost with most, babe.
Beetlejuice, rated PG. Now playing at a theater near you.
You brought up earlier, John, that, you know, it was really like the acting, I think, that really made this movie. I mean, this could have been a really bad movie with weaker actors, I think, for sure. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. Yeah, easily, easily.
And everybody, like, I mean, this one had a young Alec Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
As the main character, Adam Maitland. They were almost like Ozzie and Harriet couple, right? I mean, they were just like super,
very much.
They played off each other so well.
Yeah, they played just so well together. I believe that they were a happy couple. I mean, it's like I said, they just pulled it off so well. That made it their situation that much more funnier. That was such a big contrast.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think it was Alec Baldwin's just the way he acted it and the way he carried off the role that really helped.
I mean, it really shows how much of an awesome actor he is, because in hindsight, we know nobody is happy being married to Alec Baldwin at this point.
Yes. Good point. So true. Valid point. Valid point.
There's even a scene where it's right toward the beginning, and it's, I think it's before they die, actually, when somebody's at the door and they're this happy couple up in the attic and they're like, better go get the door. Oh no. And they're playing a little grab ass and they're kissing. They're like, you go get the door. Ha ha ha. And then like, she goes to answer and he kind of smacks her on the butt a little bit. Like, they're just this fun, very happy couple. And it takes, it takes work to do that on screen when you're not a real couple. Even if you are, it takes work. So you got to give that credit to the lead actors.
Yeah. I mean, and the other half of that couple is Gina Davis, who in the 80s, Gina Davis was awesome. I mean, she was in a lot of really great roles, a lot of quirky roles. Mm-hmm. And there's even like Tim Burton recognized who she was and he added some stuff to the movie, specifically calling out some of her past. So you remember she was in a movie with Jeff Goldblum called The Fly, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Of course.
So there's a line where Beetlejuice, remember, he's in his grave and he's calling the little fly over and he pulls the fly into the grave and eats him.
Yeah.
And you hear the fly going, help me, help me. That's a direct callback to the line from The Fly, because Gina Davis was in that movie.
I've seen that so many times and never made that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. I figured it was a Fly reference. I kept thinking the original movie, like not Gina Davis. I was that makes sense.
Now. Right. It's really awesome. But Gina Davis is, I mean, I remember from stuff like, what was that, Hotel Transylvania or Transylvania 65,000, whatever that thing was.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, League of Their Own, which like we talked about. Yeah. Yeah.
In Accidental this movie, tourist. It's really fun because I feel like Alec Baldwin is kind of the indecisive part of the couple. And she is the one who gets shit done. Like when he steps off the porch the first time when they're dead, she yanks him back from the sandworm.
Yep.
And she's like, oh, Adam, no, we can't let, you know, Beetlejuice have Winona Ryder's character because he's evil and she's a great person and I want to be with her. She's the one making decisions for the couple in a lot of scenes. Yeah. And I think she comes off much stronger than her character might have been written just from her presence as an actress. Mm. And I really appreciate her.
Mm-hmm. And isn't she the one that first pulls the trigger and summons Beetlejuice? She's the one that finally makes the call.
Yeah, because she's tired of just sitting around trying to read the book that reads like stereo instructions.
Like
she's
fed up with that whole situation. Yeah. I made the decision. We're going to do it. Yeah. And then, of course, she does. And it's not the first time we see Beetlejuice, but we finally see him in action. But Michael Keaton, the next one on our list, who plays, obviously, Beetlejuice. What a weird, cryptic, off-the-wall character. And I just rewatched this the other night, and I have no trouble believing it was improvised, but I was watching that, and I could see a less courageous actor not playing this role so far over the top.
Mm-hmm.
But he does. He's dancing around. He's doing crazy stuff. He's making up voices. He's doing all... I bought it. It didn't. Yeah. I wasn't like, if somebody who's not that great would do that, I'm like, oh, I'm so embarrassed for you, you know, doing something.
Yeah.
I never watch it with a critical eye like I did last week, but him in this role is just Michael Keaton absolutely balls to the wall doing, you know, they say on stage, do it bigger, do it bigger. He did it like he was on stage. Everything was bigger and louder and or ostentatious. And for a guy that was only on screen, what we say, 14 minutes of the whole movie, you don't walk out there forgetting him.
No. I mean, we need to spend a lot of time on Michael Keaton, because without him, I don't think this movie is even in our lexicon at this point. If you don't have Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice, I mean, maybe Sam Kinison. We talked about that earlier. But
I don't think he's done maybe. A good job.
One of the things that I find the most interesting when I'm looking up factoids and doing research and everything, you know how Michael Keaton's character of Beetlejuice has that distinctive look, right? He's got the electrified frizz. frizzy hair. Mm-hmm. He's got the mold all over his face. Looks like he's been through some shit, right?
Yeah.
That was all Michael Keaton's idea. He came to set day one, kind of had done himself up that way. I mean, not to the extreme that he is in the film, but he kind of done himself up that way, walked up to Burton and said, hey, this is kind of what I had in mind for the Beetlejuice character. And Tim Burton says, oh, shit, go straight to makeup and tell him to do this, but slightly better.
Right. And exaggerated.
That's how he ended up. Yeah. I mean, the man, he has an incredible range, right? You talk about Mr. Mom, Gung-Ho, Batman, Beetlejuice, all the way up to the stuff he's done present day in Marvel and other franchises. He's got an incredible range. Is there anything Michael Keaton can't do as an actor? I don't think there is.
I remember walking out of the theater seeing this the first time, and it was one of the first times I'm like, not every actor could have done that. You know, I mean, it occurred to me, I'm like, not like that was something special, the person who could do that role. And they said, John, like, pull it off so you believed it. You know, it was like a little bit more probably would have been too much. You know, a little bit less probably wouldn't have been enough. I mean, he hit just exactly where that character needed to be.
And I had no idea he had also contributed to the look.
I didn't either.
Which means that not only did he embody the character, he brought his imagination of its outward manifestation, his appearance. So it's even more, he's even more responsible for that character than I even knew before this podcast, which is, look at the cool shit we learn in this podcast. It's so cool. Yeah, all sorts of stuff.
Maybe I'll start listening to it.
Yeah, you should, George. It's really interesting. You might enjoy it.
So, I mean, and we have to talk about the other major people in this movie. So Winona Ryder, Winifred early roles. Yeah, I mean, one of her early, I think she had done like one or two things before this, but nothing huge. Like, this is, I think, what catapulted her into the limelight.
Lydia.
Perfect casting. Absolutely perfect. She pulled the sort of deadpan, sort of angsty kid thing perfectly. And at the end, even when she had to be like kind of, she kind of, you know, was better at the end movie, she pulled that off too. I mean, she just did like just amazing job. And I really liked her character.
Mm-hmm.
You want to hear some of the other people that were considered for that role?
Oh my God.
That you would never have believed.
Oh my God. Who?
Sarah Jessica Parker.
Duh.
Brooke Shields. Lori Loughlin. Diane Lane, Justine Bateman, Molly Ringwald, Juliette Lewis, and Jennifer Connelly. All were considered for that
Juliette
role.
Juliette Lewis, maybe. That maybe one I can Juliette almost Lewis. See. I can almost see that one. Yeah. None of the other ones really struck me.
Eventually, the runner-up was Alyssa Milano. She was the runner-up. Like, if,
what a bad
whatever,
fit.
If Winona Ryder bowed out, got sick, had COVID, what the fuck ever, it would have been Alyssa Milano. But just, I mean, all of those people are fine actresses. Every single one of them.
Yeah.
But not for the weird and strange character of Lydia Deetz.
Well, the thing about it is you have to be deadpan and flat and not want to talk and communicate, but be able to communicate with the rest of your performance because she was disaffected. She was not participating. She didn't want to be there. She didn't want to talk to people. But through her body language and the small things she did say and do, you understood her character. And that was something that, I mean, like Michael Keaton, Winona Ryder brought into the character that you otherwise might not have gotten out of another actress that didn't have that in them.
Yeah. And props to whoever made the casting decision, because if that was the other people up for it, I mean, they were all established people.
Easy to pick them.
Yeah. She was pretty much an unknown for the most part. So, you know, props whoever made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they made some really solid choices. The next one, I think he played a great role, although he's a hard guy to see in many things. Geoffrey Jones. So most people know him most famously as the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, right?
Yeah.
Nine times. It's that guy.
And Amadeus.
He plays the father, Charles Dietz. I liked him in the role. I thought he was a good counterbalance to Alec Baldwin's character.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could have had other people, though, and you might not have changed the film that much. As like if you didn't have Michael Keaton or you didn't have Winona Ryder in those roles, that would have completely changed the film. Geoffrey Jones, solid actor, enjoyed him in a lot of 80s stuff. It could have been almost anyone, though.
And I think that's a factor of the character, because this Lydia's dad, Charles, he isn't a force that moves the story forward, really.
He kowtows
to the wife and to the daughter and to what they want and his business partners and stuff. He's just trying to satisfy everybody. He's like a little yes man that sees a little opportunity to do something. So since you don't have to be the one who pushes the story, I think that's probably why of the, many of the main characters, he was the most replaceable because the character had the least to do. He was just kind of there.
Although because he was so deadpan, I think toward the end when the Maitlands are like falling apart, you know, decaying, he was the one that said, we should stop this, you know, which I was
he
like,
was. Sure. That's true.
And that part, I was like, wow, that's kind of a little like, huh. You know, of all the times for him to stand up, I was like, okay.
He like, wow, a backbone.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Didn't know you had one. Up next is Charles's wife, Delia Dietz. This was the character that was pushing the story. Yeah. This is Catherine O'Hara.
Love her.
Most recently, probably famous for her role in Schitt's Creek. She's also a regular in the Christopher Guest films, you know, Waiting for Guffman and Spinal Tap and all those films, right? So she's a regular player in that. But in this, she was the catalyst that was making these things happen. She was the one with the creepy art. She was the one that wanted the house redecorated. She was the one that absolutely wanted to get into the attic. She's the one that told Lydia, go and get your ghost. We decided to do this kind of thing.
Yeah. Right.
She was the one that's browbeating the husband that was making the Maitland so upset. And I found her performance to be irritating in the way that I think it was supposed to be. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I didn't like her, but I wasn't supposed to. So,
right.
One of the best examples of that thought is when she is walking around with Otho and they come up to her husband's room, the room he's designated as his office, kind of relaxation space. And she's like, if you do not let me gut this house, I will go insane and I will take you with me.
And he's like, just give me this room.
Right. And you know, that's not the first time he's heard that threat.
No. And she means it. Like, I don't think it's an idle threat.
Oh, no, yeah, not. Definitely not idle.
And she's so disrespectful to the Maitland's house. She's going through with a spray paint and going, mauve on this wall. You're like, you couldn't just say it. You had to deface the wall before you did it. That's why she angered them so much. It's not just he moved in the house, but they're absolutely demolishing any remnant of the fingerprint they put on the house.
Yeah.
And back to your early point, George, about like how anybody could have probably played Charles Dietz. I think you're right, because they needed that character to almost be like background because of Catherine O'Hara's character.
To be overshadowed by Catherine O'Hara.
They needed somebody who could sort of shrink back, and he played that really well. I mean, that's kind of what he does. Yeah. But again, and Catherine O'Hara, when she did the whole singing possessed scene.
Lip-syncy stuff, yeah.
I was like,
it was actually her that suggested that music, by the way.
Oh, really? That's awesome.
She's the one who suggested Calypso for that scene. It was supposed to be a completely different form of music. And she said, well, why don't we do Calypso? And that's how the whole thing got into the Harry Belafonte soundtrack.
It was a perfect fit, too.
Is it? Like, I always felt it was a weird fit, which is why it was crazy. It's like, where did that come from out of nowhere?
Yeah.
But that's perfect, though. It's weird. That's why. It's in so the weird left movie. Field. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's actually the Maitlands trying their best to figure out, how do we haunt? I don't know, Calypso music? Like, they're just pulling the straws because they don't know what to do. I had read that Harry Belafonte, he was approached by David Geffen, who's the one who got Burton involved, and said, we're thinking of Calypso. You have this great library of music. And he had said, I talked to David Geffen. He explained it. I'd understand it, but I like the man, so I told him, let's do it. So that's how his music got in the movie.
There you go.
That's awesome. I mean, now you look at some of the secondary characters. And again, they're all just all quirky, funny, just great people. But Glenn Shaddix, who played Ortho, his character was that was also really good casting. You know, that was just really,
his exit
really
from
good
the
casting.
Movie is one of the best non-death exits of any film of that era.
Leisure suit.
Right.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It was that it was funny that when Beetlejuice was doing all this crazy stuff, I don't want to spoil anything we're talking about later. He's doing things to scare people.
It's 35 years old. It's okay.
Well, last time I talked about a 40-year-old movie, you're like, you stole my thunder. So I don't want to spoil it for you.
Oh, yeah.
So, but my point is Beetlejuice is trying to do things to scare everyone and do the things that might scare them most. The scariest thing for Otho was a bright day-glow pink suit or yellow suit or whatever
leisure
it was.
He has a leisure suit.
Powder blue leisure suit.
Powder blue, right. It was like, that's the thing scariest to him because that is too mainstream and too upbeat, which I thought was a great bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, you've got great characters. Otho is certainly one of them. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other unsung supporting characters that has some great moments in the film that progressed the storyline along was Sylvia Sidney as Juno. She's the caseworker with the slashed throat where smoke comes out of her throat.
Love her.
Because if you think about it, all of these characters kind of come in pairs, right? So you've got the Maitlands, that's the husband and wife. Mm-hmm. You've got mm-hmm. the Dietzes, the husband and wife. Mm-hmm. Beetlejuice and Lydia are certainly a yep. pair, yep. right? Then you've got Otho and Juno that are pairs for the progressions of the two different cast. Otho, he's the guy pushing the Dietzes, and Juno is the one pushing the Maitlands. The Maitlands. Right?
Oh, yeah.
All of
yeah.
these characters yeah. kind of come parallel in stories. Pairs throughout the whole thing. It's really smart the way that the writer, the screenplay guy, and Tim Burton pushed all of this stuff there. There's no point in talking about Juno forever because she has like maybe 6 minutes in the film total. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I just wanted to point out that they did such a smart job with the casting, but not just the casting, but how the characters work together.
And memorable. Yeah.
So John, did you think that George would have such like amazing insight into this movie? I'm a little surprised. That was an amazingly good point he just made.
I mean, I only watch movies like 22 hours a day.
Look, I never underestimate George's knowledge of movies. That's one thing I've never
done. That was amazing good insight. I never thought of it that way. I learned something.
Yeah.
Hey,
see George, you ought to listen to this show. It's really fascinating. You learn a lot. We had a couple of secondary characters that were surprising, and they were yeah. both these business partners who came to the dinner party that all got in on the whole Deo thing with the mm-hmm. shrimp hands and all the cool stuff. And they were people that you might not necessarily expect to see in a movie like this or a movie in general. Mm-hmm. Robert Goulet was one of the guys, right? one of the guests, played Maxie Dean. And yep. I remember looking at him and going, is that Robert Goulet?
Robert Goulet.
Is it really?
I'm like,
oh my God, it is.
The last time I saw him was on a swamp boat in Scrooged. What the hell's he doing in here?
Right? What's he doing here?
Yeah, and another odd, I mean, it worked, but Dick Cavett was
what's
Bernard.
He doing
I mean,
there?
What the hell's Dick Cavett right. doing there? I mean, the last time I saw him was my dad used to watch Dick Cavett show way yeah. back right. in the day. But that I didn't know he was still alive, quite honestly. So I was like, oh, wow,
you
he's in a movie.
Figure it had to be something to do with Tim Burton admiring him from his
I was youth. Wondering.
Maybe, yep. yeah.
It's
yeah.
got to be something like that. I mean, there's nothing I can find that says that. But considering what he did with some of the rest of his casting, I mm-hmm. would think that played a part in it. Now, for me, one of them, it's a very forgettable character, but I wanted to bring it up just briefly because it's played by two people to form one character. The Preacher. This is the weird little short creature that comes out of the warped fireplace to marry Beetlejuice and Lydia, right?
Oh, at the very end. Yeah, you're towards the very end. Yes.
Very end.
Yes, yes.
This character inside the suit was played by Tony Cox. Now, you guys might remember him. He was the elf from Bad Santa. Mm-hmm. He was also in Time yeah. Bandits, and he mm-hmm. was in one of the Friday movies, you know, the Chris Tucker films yep. with Ice yep. Cube and stuff. Mm-hmm. He's just a tremendous actor. I've loved watching him for years. He was inside the suit. The voice, however, of the Preacher was mm-hmm. played by Jack Angel. Now, why does that name sound familiar to anybody who yeah. listens to this show, unlike me, is he was one of the main voice acting guys from the Super Friends.
Hey,
he
we
played
talked
both
about
Hawkman
them.
And Flash.
Okay, that's why it sounds familiar. Yeah. Yep, yeah.
Exactly.
Yep, make the connection. It's the big mm-hmm. Gen X grown-up multiverse. All these people keep coming
that's
back.
That's right.
Yeah. There was one more little character that I thought we should talk about before we get out of this segment that didn't have a huge role, but I think it's interesting that you'll remember there's a receptionist in the afterlife mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. go to, and she's got a beauty pageant thing on, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That was Patrice Martinez, and I like the interesting little conceit that the reason all these people that have either been run over or their throat is slit or their wrist, she had her wrist, she said, mm-hmm. my accident, she sewed her
and
wrist,
had my little accident.
Is that that's what happens when you commit suicide, you become a social worker.
Yeah. You become
just like Sylvia Sidney, who was the worker, she obviously must have cut her own throat, I guess.
Yeah.
So everybody was, if you commit suicide, that's what you end up doing.
Yeah, you wind up in middle management.
Middleman. There you are.
That's
all right.
Hell.
Hey, yeah. So much great talent. I think we've done this many times in the show. We get back from the break. Let's each champion one scene or section of the film that we find most interesting or most enjoyable, and we'll talk a little bit about those. So think about what you want to pick, and we'll do it right after this break.
Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at genxgrownup.com.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice!
Yahoo! It's showtime! Hey, annoying hombres making you do stuff you hate? Don't lose your head. Make them history. Ah! Think that's scary? Watch this! Whoa! That went right through me!
Did you see that?
Now watch this. First, a double team. Now, a double scare. Nobody beats me. So when you want to scare somebody, give me a call.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Gotta go.
And we're back, and just as promised, we've taken the break to think about what is our most memorable or our favorite segment from the movie. And so, coincidentally, we've arranged them in sequence in the movie as they happen. So let me start with you, Mo. What is your favorite kind of segment you want to champion?
There was a lot of them, but one that sticks out, though, is the waiting room for the dead. You know, when you have to draw a door, you know, knock three times and go in. Mm-hmm. And basically, and that's what we come. I mean, to me, there's just so much humor. Because you see all the people, like Char guy, you know, the guy who's burned to death, apparently, and half a person, the other
guy
thing.
Who choked on the big chicken bone.
Yeah, the big chicken neck.
Stuck in his neck. Yeah.
And that's where you learn about, you know, the whole, you know, if you commit suicide, you wind up being a social worker, you work for the government, you know, kind of thing. And to me, it's just like, it was just neat because they had, obviously, because of budget, they probably had to go with a lot of practical effects, like makeup. Mm-hmm. And that's probably where the makeup award came from for all this. Yeah. And just that, and also, and part of that was just meeting Juno, because I just loved her character.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. She was just so, like, just the tough woman who smoked and smoke came out of her neck.
Yeah.
Over it. She's so disaffected. She's like, you ignorant people. You didn't read the book. What do you want from me? Kind of thing.
She's
seen this a million times. She's been through this. Yeah.
So that's one of mine for sure.
You know, Mo, it's funny that you picked that scene because there's a little piece of trivia there. You notice how in that scene, we understand that the receptionist, she informs us, this is what death looks like for this person, what death looks like for those people, because as people die, that's how they are in their afterlife. Remember Flat Pancake Guy?
Yes.
Like, I'm feeling a little flat. Right? But who out of all the dead people do we see does not have their death look be permanent throughout the movie? The Maitlands.
They dry out.
Stay wet throughout the whole film. That was a practical reason. Tim Burton felt it would be too cruel to keep Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis wet throughout the entire film. It would make them too uncomfortable. So he said, nope, we're just going to let them stay dry. Mm. But everybody else had to live their death forever.
Yeah.
Maybe they died when the car hit the water, hit their head, died immediately, so they didn't get wet.
But they were wet at first. When we first got back to the house, they were wet. I hadn't thought about that. You're trying to help.
I know I am. How about you, John? What was yours?
So mine is two little pieces that are together for two different reasons, but they chain together. So the first part is the seance where, like, okay, if the ghosts won't come out, we're going to get them.
Oh, yeah.
So they get Otho to perform a seance. They bring the wedding clothes that they found in the closet. Mm-hmm. And as he's doing the seance, the clothes are filling out and then they're getting old and they're starting to decay. And first I thought that was so weighty. Like, it was such a dramatic part. It was played for, the effects were kind of B-movie, you know, like you had said, the guy's jaw falls off at one point. It's kind of over the top, but there were stakes. Like, you're literally killing these ghosts now. You bring them in, and it was a scary segment in a movie that was a supernatural thing that wasn't necessarily scary, even though it was about ghosts. So I like the tonal shift there. You're like, oh, shit's getting real, was the feeling I got. And that was the impetus that made Lydia finally decide to summon Beetlejuice herself.
Right.
And that little scene, that little moment where it's cutting back and forth between, she says, Beetlejuice, and it cuts to him kind of sitting there going, huh? Is it about to happen? And she says it again, Beetlejuice. And then he does that thing that's like, he's brushing off his sleeves. Yeah. He's like, oh boy, here we go. He's like really ready. And then she says it a third time. It's showtime. And that is just so, I get chills now thinking about it because the character is so manic. You've seen
seen what he's kind of capable of. And now he's been welcomed into the real world by this girl. And oh, shit. And I felt it. And I felt in his eyes and in Michael Keaton's performance, this guy is about to absolutely unleash everything he's been wanting to unleash on anybody's in front of him. And you know it's about to go sideways. And the way it's played, it goes from that twist that gets dark to the revelation that Lydia's going to do it to him going manic and breaking loose. I just think that's a great segment in there that builds and builds and it pays off in the rest of the movie.
This would have been my pick if you didn't pick it first, because
really,
like you said, yeah, because when she says Beetlejuice, and the thing is that he's like, well, he says it, his head, he's like, okay, she's gonna do it. Like it was, he wasn't even manic, really. He was super calm. Like he's just first, brushing stuff off calmly. And then when he just says, you know, it shows, it was, he said it so creepily, but he just said it like just calm. Like you know, and I said at that point in the movie, I'm like, uh-oh, like this is not gonna be good. So here's a random question.
Yes, yes.
I have to ask this. Goulet, de Cavett, you know, when they're in the, what do you call it? The carnival game where they get shot through the roof.
Yes. Yeah. The hammer thing.
Well, so Cavett's not in that scene, but that's Goulet and Goulet's wife character.
The Goulet and his wife, right?
Yeah.
Did they die?
They don't say.
Yeah. I'm just saying, what happened to them? Like,
so as far as we know, nobody actually dies in the film.
Okay.
Except we never see any deaths except for the Maitlands and the people who are already dead.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So, okay. I was just curious because they go flying off. So, yeah.
So George, what about you? Favorite segment of the movie? Same favorite part?
I do have a favorite part. It's actually, you know, I know you started off the thing saying we put these in order. This is not in order. Yours actually comes toward the end of the movie. Okay. Mine is in the middle of the movie, but it's understandable because it's probably hard to figure out which scene I'm talking about from the description I put in. Okay. My favorite scene is when Beetlejuice first meets the Dietzes. And when he first meets them is when the Maitlands summon him and he comes out and he talks to them and they are on that little railway of the second floor balcony where he becomes the snake.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the mother is touching the snake's body and she looks down.
Yeah.
And all the crazy stuff that Michael Keaton does in that point as the snake character is just absolutely hilarious to me. It's one of my favorite lines that's in there that I used to use all the time when I was in high school or like early college. Hey, Chuck, we've came for your daughter. It's a little great little... the part where like he slides underneath the Dietz's mother's like dress and she's like, she covers herself and runs in the other room.
Right.
He snaps Otho in the butt with his snake tail and sends him down the stairs. It's all great. And that's when then the Maitlands come out and Gina Davis as the action one of the couple. Mm-hmm. She says his name three times to make him disappear. And he's like, oh, no. And like the witch from Wizard of Oz, you know, you're melting. And he goes back and the rail forms. And that's when they decide, OK, we don't like Beetlejuice. We can't have him going after Lydia and her family. You know,
he's
this guy's
rogue.
Crazy. And they decide to do their own thing from that point forward. But I love that scene because there are so many different, like, fast moving points that happen in, like, literally 2 minutes, maybe three total. And the funny thing to me is I found out later on that snakehead, that was not originally based on Michael Keaton's face. Because at the time when they were creating that stuff, Michael Keaton hadn't been cast yet. They were still trying to figure out Sammy Davis Jr. or Dudley Moore or who the fuck ever was going to play Beetlejuice.
Oh,
so they had to go back and redo that stuff.
Oh, they redo it. Okay.
Oh, so initially it wasn't. Because I'm like, it looked just like him. Why?
Yeah,
like,
how the hell did he do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So initially it was Sammy Davis snake or something.
Right.
Yeah. Dudley Moore snake.
And that's why you have, you know, the Dietz's mother when she comes at the end of the film and scares the husband with the snake prop that she's done as one of her sculptures, you know. I just love that scene. It's kind of, to me, it's the turning point of the start of the second act of the movie. And I thought they did it beautifully.
Well, it's how you find out what he's capable of, just like the Maitlands did, and go, oh, now we know not to do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was actually surprised that he was actually violent. Yeah. They said he knocked the guy down the stairs. He was doing like, I was like, whoa, this guy is definitely like bad news here.
Yep. Yeah. And you see later on, like when the Maitlands are like, he's in their little diorama thing that's up in the attic and she grabs him and she's like, you leave her alone. And then he puts out the spikes out of his body.
Right. It's really cool.
I mean, he is absolutely an evil character. Michael Keaton said that he pretended that his character was not of any time. He's been around for almost forever. Mm. And the stuff that he's gone through, like he talks about in that one little scene, you know, went through the Black Plague and blah, blah, blah. it's all just made him absolutely no morals whatsoever. He just like, there's no consequences for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he's going to do what he's going to do.
Man, this movie. Okay. My second favorite part is the whole rest of the movie. Then I'm going to pick a second thing. It's just so much fun. Rewatching it, I thought, oh, I'm going to rewatch this movie. And about 5 minutes into it, I'm like, I'm so happy. This ain't homework anymore. I'm just having a great time rewatching this movie. It's so good. Okay. We get back one more segment. We're going to talk a little bit about, once that movie is now in the zeitgeist, it's part of pop culture, the lasting legacy it has had on pop culture in general. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/patreon.
Don't touch that dial, because now the only place you can have a wild time with TV's zaniest ghost is weekday mornings on Fox.
I'm ready, but are you ready for me?
So wake up and smell.
My socks.
Say the magic words.
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
And start your day with one wild and wacky ghoul.
You're gonna love it.
Yeah. Catch Beetlejuice Monday through Friday mornings only on Fox.
All right.
Look at the legacy. I mean, one of the things that was almost like one of the characters in this movie was the house itself. You know, remember like when they made it, like when it was first original, then they made it all like weird and fancy.
Right.
Well, all that was basically, they filmed it in this town in Vermont called East Cornith, which has a population of 926 people. It's a super nice small town.
Little tiny town. Yep.
And they said that they still, but that was where they did it. It was supposed to be Connecticut or something, but they used that for the setting. And they said people still come and visit to see like the hill where the house was and see a lot of the settings and stuff. They had like people kept some of the fiberglass headstones they had to do for the fake cemetery in the movie. But they said like people in the town now, they're kind of a little over it, it sounds like, from what I was like, they're like, oh God, tourists are back. You know, they come early fall, you know, they gotta take a picture on the damn hill, you know, overlooking the Beetlejuice thing. But it's just funny that even to this day, though, people still want to make that little trip and see this.
Yeah. You know, like that, there's a town, I think it's just outside of Cincinnati or whatever, where A Christmas Story was filmed and the real house is really there on the street.
Right.
And that's become, you know, and I remember I went and visited there when I used to travel a lot, and you can go and visit the house and take a tour and they have it mocked up like it's actually in the movie. But all the people, it's just in a neighborhood. It's just down at the end of a street. It's not like, you know, it's not on 5 acres for parking, and everybody is like, you know, signs, don't park here, not Christmas house thing, whatever. And because like you said, the people there in Vermont are probably sick of it because people just come and clog the town just to take their picture and leave. But I could get why that would be irritating, because I've seen it firsthand with that other place.
Oh, for sure.
Other things make a legacy. And one of the biggest parts of this legacy is, Jesus Christ, there's going to be a sequel.
I know.
Holy crap.
But I was shocked.
Yeah.
So, at first, I was worried it was a remake.
No, no, it's a sequel. Yeah, it got announced on May 10th of this year, 2023. It's got a theatrical release date right now of September 6th, 2024. So,
okay, let's see,
about like 10 months from when you're going to hear this podcast for the first time. I'm really looking forward to it, mainly because Keaton, Ryder, and O'Hara have all been recast to reprise their roles.
That's awesome.
So there's your answer. No, she didn't die. O'Hara's character didn't die.
Right. Now, some of the people obviously can't be there because they passed. But the thing that's going to be interesting is Lydia's daughter is going to be played by Jenna Ortega.
Oh, wow.
And there's also going to be probably the creepiest actor next to Joaquin Phoenix. Willem Dafoe is going to be in this goddamn movie.
Please tell me he's another... human exterminator. Like, he could be another Beetlejuice type character. Couldn't he be?
Possibly. Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe the Green Goblin is dead now, and so maybe that character is going to be in this.
I'm a bit of a scientist myself, Oof. Beetlejuice. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
I cannot wait for that. Look, if it didn't have Keaton in it, I wouldn't be interested. But because he's in it, you'd have
yeah.
to have.
Yeah.
They say who's directing?
No, I don't know anything about directing.
No, Tim Burton. Okay. He's involved. He might just be executive producing, but he's definitely involved. I don't remember, but okay. I know he's okay. part of it. Yeah. They actually said that Keaton, I read an article, he wasn't really like enthusiastic about reprising his role until he got a look at what they were looking to do, and then he signed on. When I hear things like that, I'm like, oh, so it wasn't just a paycheck. There's something in the script that made the actor interested. Because Michael Keaton doesn't need the money. He's making rent, right? So he doesn't have to do this if he doesn't want.
Yeah, he's got Marvel money now.
Yeah, he does.
Tim Burton is directing it, by the way.
He is. Okay. Yeah, yes. He was involved.
I just looked it up.
Yeah. I had the wonderful opportunity to see the Broadway production of Beetlejuice when I was in Manhattan a few years ago. And I always am worried, like, what are you going to do with it for a stage show and how's it going to be? And it was fantastic. I think it's about to go on tour. It's off of Broadway now. It's about to go on tour. When that thing comes around, if you are at all apprehensive about, I don't know if I want to see what they do with Beetlejuice on a live production, don't worry. It is so good. They take some license with it a little bit, of course, but it's the same kind of dark, weird, creepy thing that you would expect it to be. And the songs in it are, of course, this wasn't a musical movie, but the songs they do in it, they make sense and they drive the story. It's not just, let's stop and sing and dance. It's a song about what's happening in that part of the film. And they make some slight changes to the narrative a little bit, but it doesn't deviate from the overall story. It's phenomenal. If you get a chance to see it, you should. And I'll see it again. If it comes to my town, I'll go see it again. It's just that good.
Okay, cool. So do you remember the animated series when that came out?
End of the 80s.
Yep. It was
'91.
I remember watching it because it was cute, actually.
Was it?
It was Lydia and Beetlejuice and they were going adventures. You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's that pairing you were talking about, George.
Yeah,
they're the pair. Yeah, they're the pair. Yeah.
And they said it ran for 2 years. It said, no, not bad. Or 3 years, actually. So not a horrible run for an animated series back then, but it was cute.
No.
You know, and I think Tim Burton was involved in that animated series as well, too. So I think he had a little bit of his touch in it. So it was definitely it was a good show. Yeah.
You know, I read an article that was talking about the overall feeling of the film and what it was kind of doing. And they talk about how, and I didn't see this when I watched it, but it does make sense in this article. And it it's kind of deep, actually, how the Maitlands had a pretty mundane life.
Yeah.
They were a single couple. They were taking a staycation. They weren't living an exciting life. They were staying home. They were looking forward to it. They were talking about maybe trying to have a child again. But they were somebody said they were like the Cleavers, right? They were just so Ozzy and Harriet. They were just so plain and they were living this mundane life. And then when they die, there isn't something fantastical. It's yet another mundane existence to learn the rules, read the book, go to customer support, wait in line. How basically that I read someone else said that essentially the afterlife when you had to go in was like going to the DMV, which is very much like what that waiting room was like, is to say that like the afterlife is no different from life. And so don't wait for what's coming for something amazing to happen. You need to live your life when you're alive because there's no guarantee that the afterlife is going to be any different or any more special. It's just another kind of mundane, run-of-the-mill kind of stuff that you have to endure. And that was a pretty deep analysis of what Beetlejuice's overarching story was for me that I hadn't thought about. It's about death, but it's a commentary on take advantage of life because death might not be anything better, you know?
It reminds me of the scene when Lydia's talking to Beetlejuice and she's like, I want to be where you are. And Beetlejuice is like, why?
Yeah, why? You don't want to be here. Yeah.
You know, and then he's like, why? It was one of his few genuine moments. He's like, what? Like, why? You know?
Because the thing that she says to him is so unbelievable. He's like, what the fuck are you saying?
Yeah. Don't you know how good you have it right
now? No sense at all. Yeah. You're living. I would kill to do that, right? Yeah.
Right.
You know, one of the longest lasting legacies of the film is something that probably a lot of people don't consider. And that's that it really brought the goth lifestyle into the mainstream and popularized it, right? Lydia being in that all black outfit and the veil and everything. Mm-hmm. And by the way, she didn't just do that. She also, her character, like, because she was strange and unusual, she would repurpose the other characters' clothes in later scenes. There's one scene where she's wearing as pants one of her father's sweaters that had been in a previous scene. There's another part where she's got this head wrap kind of thing on her head, and that's actually made up of the gloves from her mother. And she does that throughout the film.
I didn't notice that.
But
I didn't either.
Everything is black wardrobe, pale face, kind of goth lifestyle. And I know that we have seen a million comedians poke fun at the fact that goth people dress up as goth because they want to be different, but they're part of a movement that all wants to be that same black lipstick, black thing kind of thing. So it's
conforming to the different is still conforming. That's weird.
Yeah, exactly. But I think Beetlejuice really helped bring it to a main part of America that would have taken a longer period of time to catch up to that. Goth might have only been in a couple of places at that point until Beetlejuice became this big popular movie and people across the Midwest and heartland of America said, oh, I can dress in black and wear black lipstick and have black fingernail paint. I want to do that because I'll be different.
And it makes me strange and unusual. Yes,
exactly. Yes.
After that movie, I mean, you saw it in all these movies. I mean, there were tons of movies where you had goth
teenagers,
teenagers especially coming in. So yeah, it never occurred to me that this is like one of the first ones, you know, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Problematically, throughout the course of this backtrack, I'm afraid we have said Beetlejuice's name more than three times. So heaven knows what's happening outside of the walls of this studio. Craziness is probably taking place. Which, by the way, what an interesting mechanism. All you had to do was say his name three times, but we couldn't tell you his name. You had to place your raids to get it, which I thought was a cute part.
Raids.
It was something that we all knew as 80s kids, because remember the whole Bloody Mary in
Bloody
front
Mary,
of the
mirror
thing?
Same mechanism. Yeah. That's right. Yep. Yeah. Just used to great effect. Oh, love this film. Love that we had an opportunity to sit down together and talk about it. Fourth listener, we certainly hope you enjoyed this edition of The Backtrack. Before we leave, we want to send out, as always, a huge heartfelt thanks to everyone who supports us financially over at patreon.com/GenXGrownUp. These are people that know that we do what we do for free and are still willing to help out for as little as $1 a month. You also can support us financially. It means the world to us. Just head over to genxgrownup.com/Patreon. Both of those URLs I just used work, and become part of the army of people that are helping ensure we continue to bring you these shows. We certainly would appreciate it. That's going to wrap it up for this backtrack, guys. I have had a blast. Listener, don't worry. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. Next week, we'll be back with a standard edition of our show. Until then, I am John. George, thank you so much for being here.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know I appreciate you.
Always fun, man.
Fourth listener, though, it is you that we all appreciate most of all. And we cannot wait to talk to you again next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
Gen X Grown Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com. No more washy shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be
french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up. Okay, so we're going to get some email.
Okay, what to do?
She was not Miss Argentina. That's the character's name.
Oh, really? Well, I misread that then. She's not. I misread it as Patrice Martinez is Miss Argentina. She was the afterlife receptionist, but it's as, not is. So I misread it. Actually, and then I went off on
I was like, holy cow, I was learning something else here for a second. You know?
There we go. We have a blooper. Congratulations. Yeah. Me being totally
wrong
about
that. You
don't
have to really.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Woo! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.